again. And let's see. So what I just want to recap what we did yesterday. So yesterday we did a very simple experiment. We had Alice at rest in still air, and we had Bob moving past her like this. And remember, as soon as Bob moves past her, she starts her watch going. She waits for a certain time T. She claps her hands. A sound signal goes chasing after Bob, and it reaches Bob, and then Bob claps his hands, sends a sound signal back to Alice. And we came up with this picture here. So here is Alice. Alice is at rest with respect to the air. Okay, and so her world line is just vertical like that. Okay, and remember, we're plotting the speed of sound C times time for Alice. And what's Bob doing? Well, Bob is drifting across her frame as time goes on. So his world line, he crosses her path over here, and his world line goes up like this. And so this is Bob's time axis. His clock is ticking, tick 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on his clock, okay, as he's floating across her space. And just to, as a reference here, at 45 degrees, what's at 45 degrees? So if Alice were to have clapped her hands at the same time that Bob passed her location, then this sound wave would travel faster than Bob and would go, you know, further than him in a given time. Okay, so this is a sound wave. So this is 45 degrees. And here C is the speed of sound. Okay, so we got that. And then as soon as Bob crosses her path, she starts her stopwatch, and she waits a certain time, capital T, on her clock. And then she emits a sound wave. She claps her hands. So because we're plotting C times T, we put CT here. Okay, and then that sound signal goes out at 45 degrees, like this. It catches up with Bob. And then he claps his hands, and he sends the sound signal back like that. And the important thing here is that this is 45 degrees, obviously, because Alice is at rest with respect to the air. And any sound that she emits, she's going to observe it to be moving at the speed of sound. But this one here is also at 45 degrees. And this is the important one. This is also at 45 degrees, even though Bob is a moving source. Bob is drifting with respect to the air. He claps his hands. But as soon as he claps his hands, he sets up a disturbance in the still air. And then that sound radiates outwards with respect to the still air. And so it moves through the still air at a speed C back to Alice, who is at rest with respect to the still air. And so she sees that sound wave coming at her with a speed C. So it's also 45 degrees. And that's crucial here. So all right, so we got that. And also, we put a couple of other things in the picture. We labeled Bob's velocity v. He's drifting with a speed v to the right. And we suppose that the instant Bob receives her sound signal, the instant he hears Alice's clap, we suppose that he has traveled a distance d in Alice's space. So he started at Alice's location, and he drifts, do, 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 do. When he hears the clap, he's a distance d away from Alice. Okay, and then the beautiful thing about plotting CT versus X instead of T versus X is these are 45s. And so if that's D, then what's that? D, and that's also D. Okay, so actually, let's put this down here. CT is that guy there. Okay, so that's our picture there. And from that picture, what we did is, actually let me just put the word subluminal, subsonic here. Okay, so Bob is moving at subsonic speeds, so slower than the speed of sound. Okay, so so that's that. And the most important thing on this picture is this time here. Okay, so we're wondering how much time has elapsed for Bob. Okay, so what we do know is that time must be proportional to CT. So we talked about that as well. So if this, so we said it was K times CT. That's the number of tick marks on here representing the ticking of Bob's clock. Okay, and the reason for that is remember, if we were to double this time, say make it this big, then we would also double this time. Okay, so whatever this time is, that's our unknown, it must be just proportional to that time over there. Okay, so that diagram there makes no assumptions whatsoever. Okay, it's super basic physics. It's just Alice at rest in air, Bob drifting through, and everything. It's very, very simple physics. Okay, so and then what we did is we said, okay, well let's try to figure out what this k is, because that's the really important thing. Because if we know what that k is, then we know how much time elapses for Bob when a certain amount of time elapses for Alice. One way to determine k is to simply assume that when 1 second elapses for Alice, 1 second elapses for Bob, and 1 second elapses for everyone in the universe, that there's such a thing as absolute or universal time. And 1 second elapses for one person, 1 second elapses for anyone, regardless of their state of motion. In which case, we just said, oh, well, that means that this time here, d plus ct, must equal that, kct, and then we solved for k. And then we found that, in fact, k is just the ordinary Doppler shift for sound in air. Okay. What we're going to do now is we're going to drop that assumption about universal time and find a different way of calculating k, a more natural way of calculating k. And we'll find that k is not what we got before. It's something different. And it tells us that the amount of time elapsed for Bob from here to here is not the same as the amount of time elapsed for Alice from here to here. Universal time does not exist. Okay? And time is different for everybody. Everybody has their own sense of time. Okay, so that's the goal here. Okay, so to reach that goal, what we're going to do is we're going to take this picture here, which works for sound in air, and we're going to imagine that instead of Alice and Bob exchanging sound signals in air at rest, we're going to imagine that they're exchanging light signals. Okay, so the speed of sound is going to become the speed of light, and subsonic is going to become subluminal and all that stuff. So we're just replacing sound with light. Okay, so the first step here is just to sort of we have a concrete picture of what's going on, and to make the picture as close as possible to what we had for sound, what we're going to do is we're going to imagine that light is a wave in ether. So how many of you know about the concept of ether, have heard about the concept of, how many of you have not heard ether before, the word ether? Okay, so about a third of you. Okay, so it turns out that that in the early 1800s, there were experiments done which showed that light is a wave phenomenon. Okay? And so it exhibits wave properties like diffraction, interference, that kind of stuff. So everyone thought, yeah, okay, light is a wave. Great, fantastic. Okay? So then they looked at other waves. They looked at water waves, and they noticed, well, what is a water wave? A water wave is a disturbance of some medium. Okay, so the water molecules, when you splash in the water molecules are going up and down like this. Okay, so there's something waving. In the case of water waves, it's the water molecules that are waving. Okay, they also knew that sound is just vibrations of some other medium, air. Okay, and so when you talk and sound comes out, it just means that air molecules are vibrating up and down. Okay, so the air molecules are waving back and forth. So then they thought, well, okay, well, light is a wave. So what's waving? And they thought, what's waving? Well, I don't know. Can't really see anything waving. Okay? And so they invented this medium called the ether. And they imagined that the ether is this sort of elastic medium, like air or like water, that pervades all of the universe, fills all of space. And that light is just a wave in this ether. So when I click on a flashlight, what it does is, imagine this ether as like jelly. Okay, whole, you know, jelly filling the whole universe. If I jiggle the jelly over here, then it will jiggle the neighboring jelly, which will jiggle the neighboring jelly, and so on. And like dominoes, you get a wave going out. So they imagined that light is a waving of this sort of elastic medium they called the ether. Okay, so let's go with that model of light. Okay, because that model of light was actually what was used for all of the 1800s until the beginning of the 1900s. Okay, so let's suppose that light is a wave in ether for a moment. And we'll put a question mark there, okay? Because it actually will show that it's not that. But so light is a wave in ether, and that's exactly analogous to sound being a wave in air. Okay, so what we're doing is we're going to take this picture here, and in the backdrop of this picture, we have in mind still air. So now in the backdrop of this picture, we're going to have in mind ether. Okay? And Alice is at rest with respect to this mysterious medium called the ether. And she is, instead of clapping her hands and sending a sound signal, she's sending light signals. Okay? The point is that this situation here, light as a wave in ether, is completely analogous, 100% the same as sound as a wave in air. And so we can take this diagram and use exactly the same draw exactly the same picture for an experiment in which Bob is drifting through her frame, Alice waits a time t, clicks on her laser, and sends that laser light over here, and Bob has a mirror which reflects that laser light back. And the important thing is when he reflects it back, the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source. So in this case, Bob is drifting through that mysterious ether medium. But when he clicks on his flashlight or laser or sends it back with the mirror, that light travels with respect to the still ether with a speed c, which is now the speed of light. Okay? And so Alice will measure that speed to be c, independent of the motion of Bob, independent of how fast he's moving either away or toward her. So this becomes, c becomes the speed of light. And this becomes, Bob is moving not subsonic, but subluminal. Okay, and something moving superluminal would be like that, faster than the speed of light. Okay, so that's our picture. We just carry it over in its entirety without any change. Okay, so so Einstein, let's now switch to talk a little bit about Einstein and the theory of special relativity. So Einstein based his theory of special relativity on two principles. And one of those principles has to do with the speed of light. Can anyone tell me what that principle states?
Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
The statement the speed of light, the speed of light is the same quantum speed relative to anybody.
Okay.
In,
okay. Yeah.
The speed of light is the same in every reference.
Okay. Okay, so that's the general consensus of what Einstein said, is that somehow the speed of light is this universal constant, the same for everybody, the same in any reference frame, the same, blah, blah, blah. That's actually not what Einstein said. Okay, so this is a very important point that I want to make here. What Einstein actually said was this. Okay, so there are two principles, principle one and two. We'll start with principle two, which is the speed of light principle. Okay, so understanding this principle properly will help you, will really help you to understand the logic of special relativity, why it makes sense, why it's totally believable, why it's the most natural thing you could imagine, or the most natural way the universe could be. Okay, so let me actually read what Einstein said. And before I read that, I have to, before I read the principle, I need to read what he said a little bit earlier to define some terminology. Okay, so this is from his 1905 paper on special relativity. He says, let us take a system of coordinates in which the equations of Newtonian mechanics hold good. In order to render our presentation more precise and to distinguish this system of coordinates verbally from others, which will be introduced hereafter, we call it the stationary system. Okay, so what he's introducing is a reference frame, a coordinate system. Okay, so Alice in some state of motion. Okay, and such that the laws of Newtonian mechanics hold good, which means F equals ma and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so and when you throw something like this and there's no forces acting on it, it moves in a straight line and all that kind of stuff. So he's saying, suppose there exists such a frame. Okay, we will call and then we're going to do all kinds of stuff with that frame. But let's suppose there exists such a frame. Let's call that frame the stationary frame. Okay? And then he states his principle, the principle of the constancy of the velocity of light, which reads, any ray of light moves in the stationary system of coordinates with the determined velocity c, whether the ray be emitted by a stationary or by a moving body. Okay, so let me just paraphrase that. So combining what I just said, I'm going to write it this way, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, so for an observer at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the source. Okay, so that's what Einstein said. So let's have a look at this. So first of all, at rest, for an observer at rest, well, we know that there's no such thing as absolute rest. Okay, that's one of the ideas. We can anticipate what's coming. We know there's no such thing as absolute rest. There's no such thing as absolute space and all that. That's what we're going to get to. Okay, so when we say an observer at rest, we put it in quotation marks, indicating that really what we mean is what Einstein is saying here. There exists at least one frame of reference in which it is true that Newtonian mechanics holds good. Okay, if I throw an object and there's no forces acting on it, it will move in a straight line. There exists at least one frame in which that's the case. So this is the frame that Einstein calls the stationary frame. Okay, so I'll just say this thing. So there exists at least one frame in which this is true, in which the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the source. Okay, so at the time, this is 1905, people had in mind that most physicists thought that light is a wave in ether. Okay, so is this principle true for if light is a wave in ether? Why? Someone tell me why.
It's like the sound wave we were talking.
Yeah. It's exactly the same as the sound waves in still air. Okay, for sound waves it moving around in still air, if you're at rest with respect to the air, it doesn't matter how the source is moving around. If there's an ambulance coming toward you or moving away from you, the speed of sound will be the same. You will hear a Doppler shift, sure. When it's coming toward you, the frequency goes up. When it's drifting away from you, the frequency is lower. But the speed of that sound wave is always c with respect to the still air. And if you're at rest with respect to that still air, you will always measure that same speed c. Okay? And if light is a wave in ether, exactly the same thing applies. Okay? And so this principle is obviously true if light is a wave in ether phenomenon. Okay? So what I want to let's just leave it at that. So what I want to emphasize here is that this principle, it would have been completely obvious to anyone in 1905. Okay, there's nothing surprising about it. There's nothing radical about this principle. Everyone would have read that and said, "Yeah, okay, that's obvious. So what?" Okay, so let me just emphasize, because it's very important that we see why it's obvious. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of reasons why it's obvious. One is this: the people at the time had in mind a particular model of light. Okay, they didn't actually know. Well, this is what they thought light is. The fact is, we still don't know what light is exactly. Okay, we don't, because you think about string theory. Well, maybe light is these little strings and so on and so forth. Okay, we still don't actually know what light is at a really fundamental level. We understand light a lot better now than we did back then, but we still really don't know what it is. So at that time, people had this wave and ether model, this mechanical model of light. That light is this mechanical phenomenon that's a physical vibration of some medium called the ether. Just like sound is a mechanical phenomenon, it's a vibration of some physical medium. So they had this mechanical wave and ether model. The wave and ether model of light, just like sound and air, predicts that this is true. Okay, so everyone would have said, yeah, that's obvious. Way to go, Einstein. The second reason is people were aware also that light is an electromagnetic phenomenon. So Maxwell in the 1860s had come up with Maxwell's equations, which describe how electric and magnetic fields are unified, are just different sides of the same coin, how they work together, how one oscillates and then the other oscillates and so on, how they work together to produce an electromagnetic wave. Which moves through space and carries energy and momentum and all that kind of stuff. And it was known that light is an example of an electromagnetic phenomenon. So it's light is electromagnetic waves of a certain wavelength or a certain frequency range. Okay, so the second thing people would have known at that time is that Maxwell's equations, which describe light, which are the mathematical embodiment of how light behaves, Maxwell's equations also predict this. Okay, so I should elaborate a little bit on that. So what Maxwell's equations say, wow, is that an S? Okay, so what Maxwell's equations say is that, at least classically, non-quantum mechanically, classically, the source of all light is accelerated electric charge. Okay, so what does that mean? So that means if I take a charge like this, a charge at rest will not emit light. A charge in uniform motion will not emit light. But a charge that's accelerated, if I take that charge and jiggle it back and forth, then it will emit electromagnetic waves, which is a form of light. Okay. Right, so let me put it this way. So suppose that you are out in space, floating out in space on some platform here, and you see some charge out here, and this charge is moving around in some completely random way, like this. What's going to happen is that that charge, which is accelerating, okay, it's changing its velocity, is going to be emitting electromagnetic waves. And those waves will come at you, and independent of the motion of this thing, if it's accelerating, it's going to emit electromagnetic waves, and you will see the speed of those waves to be c. Okay? If I were to take this same charge, this charge that's wiggling around here, and I were to give it an extra drift, okay, to the right, for example, or to the left, okay, so take this whole pattern of jiggling around and add sort of a drift to the right. Okay? Well, Maxwell's equations would say it's still just a charge wiggling around. Independent of the motion of that source, the speed of the waves you're going to measure is c. Okay, so everyone would have looked at that and said, okay, yep, that's right, Albert. And also, there would have been experimental evidence available at this time through astronomical observations. Okay, so it turns out that, I don't want to get into this, but it turns out that there's very, very simple observations that you can make of binary star systems. So most, the majority of stars in the galaxy are actually binary pairs, so two stars orbiting around each other. So there's plenty of examples of this. And if you look with a telescope, you will, and you study the motion of these guys, you will also conclude that that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source in that case being either star. So at one time, the star is moving toward you, at another time, it's moving away from you, and so on. So simple observations, which I don't want to get into, give you strong experimental evidence that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the source. Okay, so everyone would have believed this. Everyone would have said, yep, totally obvious. I want you to compare this statement that I wrote down here with a seemingly, with a closely related statement, but totally different statement. And that is, and let's call it P2 prime. Okay, so this is what Einstein did not say. Okay, if we were to take this statement and we were to replace the word observer here with source, and replace the word source with observer, so just interchange those two words. Okay, so it's exactly the same statement. For a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer. Okay. So that seems like a simple switch around, right? No big deal. But if we think about it for a minute, it is a big deal. This is a totally bizarre statement. Okay, so for a source at rest, the speed of light is c independent of the motion of the observer. So that's like saying, suppose I have a flashlight here, which is at rest. It's a source of light, which is shining a beam this way. And that it would be telling me that the speed of light is independent of the motion of the observer. Okay, so suppose we've got this beam of light coming toward me, and I'm at rest with respect to that source, to that flashlight. So I'm, how do I measure the speed of light? Well, what I do is I take a meter stick like this. I time how long it takes a light wave front to cross from one end of the stick to the other end. I time how long it takes, and I divide, and I get the speed of light. Okay? And I would find, you know, 3 times 10 to the 8 or whatever. Now, this is saying that I would get the same value for the speed of light even if I were running toward that light, which is completely bizarre. I mean, if light is a wave in ether, okay, it's moving at some speed, c, with respect to that still ether. If I now start moving with respect to that ether, moving toward that light with a speed v, what speed should I measure for the speed of light? C plus v. If I'm running away from the flashlight, what speed am I going to measure? C minus v, right? So what if light instead is particles? Suppose we have particles coming out of this flashlight with some speed c, drifting through empty space. Okay, so if I'm at rest with respect to the flashlight, I see them whipping by me with a speed c. If I'm running toward those particles with a speed v, I'm going to measure. If I'm running away, okay, so it's totally bizarre, right? So this statement makes no sense. This statement is completely unbelievable. Okay, so just wanted to point that out. Okay, so this is totally bizarre. P2 prime, totally bizarre. Okay, so at the end of the day, what we're gonna show is that P2 prime actually follows from this and the relativity principle. And the goal of special relativity was to try to understand, because this is in fact true, okay, but it's not at all obvious how it could possibly be true. And the goal of special relativity is to understand why this is true. Okay? So that's what we're gonna get to. All right, so in order to get there, we need Einstein's second principle, which is the more important principle, which is the relativity principle. Okay, so